Accession with 32121, real one.
Yep.
Okay, this is Victoria Kingston interviewing Peter Harrington on the 2nd of March 2009. And if we could just start off talking about a bit about your background and where you grew up and where you were born.
Yep. Well, I came from a military family. My father was a serving soldier. And I was actually born while he was at the School of Artillery at Lark Hill. I later became a gunner, and so couldn't have been more appropriate, really. So yes, I was born at Lark Hill when he was at the School of Artillery. We then, later, he volunteered to serve with the British Army in India. So we went from Borden, I think it was, we were then at, out to India. What was then India, but which of course now, the part that we were in is now Pakistan, because he served at a place called Hyderabad. There are two Hyderabads, Hyderabad Sindh and Hyderabad Deccan, and he served at Hyderabad Sindh, where we were for a number of years, and then we rotated with another unit, which was in Quetta. But unfortunately, this would have been 1935, and unfortunately shortly after we got there, there was an earthquake, a massive earthquake. It killed something like about 38,000 people. So we lost our house. We didn't lose anybody in the family. Very few service people were actually affected, except for the Royal Air Force. Their cantonment was, and their airfield was devastated. But ours wasn't too bad, but we did lose our house and everything else. And so we returned then to Hyderabad. And later, he found a military school for me to go to in Rajputana. And then, by then, the regiment had moved up onto the northwest frontier at a place called Nowshera. And so I went to the Lawrence School at Mount Abu, and then I joined the family. Actually, I had to go to Delhi and meet my father, and then we went on to Nowshera, and from Nowshera we eventually left and came back in 1939, it would have been, that we came back to England.
Okay.
And I had my 10th birthday on the boat, it was a troop ship, and they were fairly ancient old troop ships, but anyway, I have my 10th birthday on that. Then we went, my mother was a Brighton girl, we went however to, the regiment was posted to Borden again in Hampshire. And we had a quarter there, but then of course in 1939 when the war came, my father's regiment went straight to France, and so we lost the quarter. If the breadwinner wasn't there, as it were, in those days, you couldn't occupy the quarter. And so we moved then into Brighton, and into a village called Woodingdean, just outside. And my father had once again found a military school for me to go to, and so I was due to go to the Duke of York's, the Royal Military School at Dover, but of course they were evacuated, and I eventually joined them at Cheltenham, but then the army wanted the place that we were at. It is now actually the GCHQ at Benall Farm in Cheltenham. And we were evacuated again to North Devon. And we had a place at Saunton, which is just beyond Barnstaple in North Devon. And what is fascinating is that a lot of American films have just come to light about the practice that they put in, because of course the beaches at Braunton and Saunton and Woolacombe, they were absolutely ideal for D-Day. And so when the Americans came over in 1942, they used those beaches to practice at. And some of these films have just come to light, and I should be fascinated to see them, because of course we watched the training day in and day out, didn't we? And then eventually we came back to Dover. The school was didn't come back until 1946, actually, the Easter of 46. And then in 1947, in February, I left and joined the army with a view to taking a commission. But I had to join as a regular soldier and then pass various... There was no civil service board in those days. You could later take the civil service examination and pass for Sandhurst through that. But I couldn't, and so I went in as a regular soldier and I went through the machinery and eventually ended up at Sandhurst in 1947 and then was commissioned in 1949, that's right, into the artillery.
And your father was serving in the Second World War, was he, while you were at school?
Oh, he served, we very rarely saw him. He served in the Second World War. He was very fortunate. He came out at Dunkirk, his regiment was split up, he was commissioned. He'd been the regimental quartermaster sergeant of a field regiment in 1939-40, but when they got back, he didn't rejoin the regiment. He was commissioned and became the quartermaster, the commissioned quarter, lieutenant quartermaster of 107 Heavy Anti-Aircraft Regiment, which you might say, well, Heavy Anti-Aircraft Regiment, but they had an incredible war. They were selected for all sorts of things. The adjutant, in the end, the adjutant, I say the original adjutant was a bit of a drunk, and so he went, and my father had to do, officers were short, and my father had to be the adjutant and the quartermaster until they said, we'll have a look at the next bunch or group that come out of the officer cadet training unit, and we'll take the best on their report. And the best was a chap called Edward Heath. So Teddy Heath was the adjutant then throughout the war. And we were good friends with Teddy, my mum and dad. But I saw very little of my father throughout the war. But then at the end of the war, he stayed on with the military government in Germany, in Hanover. And I acquired then a certain amount of German, which led on later when I'd been commissioned and so on. I thought I would take a language which would enhance my chances of going to Staff College. And so I spent 6 months with a German family learning how to speak German. And
you were building on a base of German that you
already had. Yeah, that I had. I passed the interpretership examination and was posted to the intelligence unit at the headquarters of British Army of the Rhine. And that's where, of course, then, the interesting stuff came.
Okay. Yeah. I want to talk about that, but just to go back to joining the army in the late 40s.
Yeah.
The enemy obviously had changed quite suddenly from being Germany and then the war to Russia.
Yes.
Could you talk a bit about that, having grown up in the war?
Yes, of course, like everybody else during the war, you kept little maps and put pins in when the Germans were advancing or retreating or whatever. When the Germans then really made the mistake of invading Russia, we were all dismayed because all our little pins were going, the Nazi pins were going forward, or the German pins were going forward, and the Russians were going back. But then eventually, yes, you followed the war day by day, really. We didn't have a wireless set but we had bulletins put out, and we had somebody who would, when something momentous happened, the teacher on duty or the sergeant major on duty would tell you what had happened. And I remember being in the dining hall, and one of the teachers called Hunt came in, and he said, "I'm sorry to tell you boys, the hood has been sunk." You see, well, we all knew what the hood was. We knew every aeroplane. We knew everything that there was to know about the war. I mean, I could recognize any aeroplane that came into the sky. And he said, "The hood's gone down." So that was terrible. But then, of course, he kept us in touch as the Bismarck was chased. And then eventually the Bismarck was sunk, and big cheers and so on. So yes, you followed the war. And then you had no real ideas at that age about communism or fascism or whatever it was, you as ideologies, and so you looked on the Russians, of course, as allies. They were just beating the Germans, weren't they? And it was as simple as that. It was only later, when it was fairly obvious that Joseph Stalin had done everybody down, that they had established themselves with a buffer zone in Europe. They weren't going to give up, we thought, in a hurry.
Can you remember when you first joined the army that people realising that actually the new enemy was the Soviet Union?
No.
Was it very gradual?
It wasn't. It was very gradual. Although, you see, Churchill was the Prime Minister just not after the war, but then the second, on his second bout, as it were. And then we were made aware of the fact that the Russians were the enemy, because he instituted all sorts of little defensive measures that in case anything should happen and so on. We had appreciated the strength of the atomic devices that we had, and we thought, well, it couldn't be anything to overcome this, and so therefore the Russians weren't that much of a threat.
So they didn't yet have
the
war.
They didn't,
so
no, not at that stage, yes, yeah, yeah. But you did then gradually appreciate that you'd got a new enemy, because it was, you then sort of studied a bit more perhaps of what the communist ethic was, and you appreciated that they could, and of course they were extremely powerful. They had kept virtually the army with which they ended the war, whereas we didn't. I mean, ours all went home, didn't they? It took them a long time, but some of them were 6 months before they were demobbed, but they'd gone home, and so we had to start afresh.
So the army you joined was downsizing hugely.
Oh yes, it did. But it still had national service, because national service lasted till about 1963, something like that, 1962 perhaps. And so you had this enormous turnover of recruits. I was involved at one stage with training national service soldiers. But you're right, the army had gone down to, when I was in Germany, we had something like, I suppose, about three or four divisions. So what have we had at the end of the war? Enormous number of divisions, yeah.
And just while we're on the subject, what was it like dealing with national servicemen as a regular soldier?
Very interesting and amusing. Because they came in as civilians, they changed quickly. Many of them had never been away from home, hadn't been out of their villages or whatever it was. And there they were, sort of all lined up in their civilian clothes. And then eventually you gave them, after day or one or two, you gave them a uniform. So then they started to become uniform. Then they had all had the haircut and so, and they were all reduced then to a sort of nothingness. But then gradually the personalities came through, and the people who were obviously going to be the NCOs and so on, you could see them, and you could encourage them, and so life was very basic. I mean, some of them were, I used to cry at night because they'd never been away from home. It was very sad for them, you know. And there they were having to do 2 years. Many of them were unfit. Many of them were malnourished and things like that. But of course, then they gradually built up. And there were some excellent National Service soldiers. And I have a very interesting little tale in that one of them that I had, I ran football teams, I was a bit of a sportsman, I ran football teams and hockey teams and things like that. And so I ran the regimental football team. Well, one chap came through and on his form he'd put occupation, professional footballer. Well, what was I going to do? I kept him there, you see, and he turned out to be a very good footballer. I was allowed to have something like 3 professional footballers on the field at one time. So I had my 5, something like that. This chap was absolutely outstanding. There were 2 of them that were really outstanding. And this chap in particular. Anyway, he played for Blackburn and I kept in touch with him. He was badly injured in the in a cup final against Wolves. He got compensation. He bought, he turned out to be an extraordinary entrepreneur. He bought a stall in a market, then he had 2 stalls, then he had a mini market, then he had a supermarket, and in the end, he had a firm which still exists, but he doesn't own it now. It was called JJB Sports, and his name is David Whelan. Well, David Whelan's worth 220 million. He sold it for 220 million. And Dave and I are still good friends from National Service days. And if I want to go to any of the, because he has Wigan, and if I want to go to any of the Emirates or anything like that, I ring up and I go into the boardroom at, and watch any football matches. And I go to Wigan and meet Dave. He has a hotel. Pat and I stay at the hotel and go to the match and so on, yeah.
That's all because of National Service?
All because of that National Serviceman. I looked after him.
Yeah.
I don't want to bore you with the stories, but I did look after him quite closely and encouraged him, and he was able to go away and play for Blackburn quite often. And then he played for the Army and so on. So, yeah, that was a National Serviceman. Cast your bread upon the waters and it comes back cake, as my mother used to say. Yeah.
Okay, well, should we talk a bit about going to Germany the first time? So you said that
1951. When I went for the first occasion, my father had stayed with the military government, and then eventually families were allowed to go and join their husbands, and that was the winter of 1946. Which was absolutely terrible. It's a ghastly winter. And we lived in Hanover, which was a pile of rubble. We had a very nice house, a quarter there. And I made friends with the Germans that my father was associated with. And so I thought, well, this is ridiculous. I've got to be able to... Oh, yeah, French was no good, was it? And so, which is what we'd learned at school. And so I taught myself a bit of German, and I was really reasonably fluent eventually, because when I went to Sandhurst, I put myself down for beginner's German and came on, and I used to go off on leave to my parents and add to it and so on, and I became quite fluent in the end. I had what they called a preliminary interpretership. I loved those times and made good German friends, and they're still there today.
Okay.
Good friends.
So you joined the army and then you posted yourself to Germany?
Yeah, and then eventually we were posted to Germany. I took the course first of all in Celle, and that would have been I was married in 54, so that would have been about 56 that I took the course in Celle. Pat had to stay at home, and there were six officers. And we were spread amongst German families and came into the Army Education Centre during the day for other instruction. And then we went to visit new German army and all that sort of thing to add to it. Of the six, then I came out really the top of the thing to be expected because I'd had a good background anyway. And was posted then, we didn't all go into intelligence. Somebody went to an embassy and that sort of thing. But I went into the headquarters, British Army of the Rhine, to what they called, that was really the sort of highest of the intelligence cells, really. Because it directed all the other intelligence that was taking place in the British Army of the Rhine, as it was then. And we lived in Rheindahlen, which was where the big headquarters was, and Pat then came and we had a quarter there. And that's where two of the girls were born.
And can you talk a bit about what was going on there at the time in terms of intelligence gathering?
Yes. Fascinating, really. It was in a way, sometimes it was a bit like what you Kipling and the Big Game and Kim and so on, because you had what my particular job was to control sources, to analyze intelligence that was coming in, to try to target if we received intelligence and we wanted more about something, then I knew who the sources of intelligence were. That is to say, I was the liaison also with MI6. MI6 ran a unit in Berlin, and we also ran a small intelligence setup in Berlin. The two worked closely together, but of course, MI6 had the more important sources. We were always called sources. And I would be responsible for all those source reports that came in, and I would distribute them to the various desks. The desks were the biggest desk was the Group of Soviet Forces in Germany, what we call the GSFG. They had something like, the Soviets had something like 22 divisions. And so you were constantly looking for strategic and tactical pieces of information that would help you. I can give you an instance in a moment. Then we would have had somebody who looked after the East German Army. And somebody would have the East German Police, the Wopo. And so on. You had desks where these people operated from, and they were very, very good, highly intelligent. The interpreter, the CNC's interpreter, who didn't work in our department, was qualified, not could speak, was qualified in 26 languages. Huh? And if you had anything that you weren't sure of, you'd take a piece of paper to him and say, "Well, oh, that's Arabic. No, sorry, Persian." It was incredible. And so what you were doing the whole time, then we had a department which was run by a WRIC officer called Safre, and she ran our intelligence output. That is to say, she would put together, we were always aiming at, we called it the Periodic Intelligence Report, Perintrap, and it came out once a quarter. And into that, we would put everything that we had throughout the quarter. all the various studies that we'd done. For instance, we had a Polish chap called Brzezicki, very clever old bish, and he did a study. This one didn't go in because he did a study. He said there's got to be some means of interpreting tank numbers, Soviet tank numbers, you see. Well, so you'd get all the sources that you got out on in East Germany, picking up tank numbers and relating them to where they were and so on. We did a 6-month study, and in the end he said, no, it's completely, there's nothing in it at all. It's completely random. So that's one that went down the drain. But then you do other studies, and the sources that you got were the MI6 sources, who were some of them, one of them in the railway was fantastic. You had to be very, very careful to protect them, not just from the East Germans, but from the Americans, you see, because their ideas were entirely different to ours. They would blast the thing with money. Well, and then eventually the chap would get caught because he'd be careless or whatever. So we had the MI6 sources. Then we had our own a little intelligence source, a very low level, like cleaners in a barracks or a milkman delivering to Soviet barracks and that sort of thing. And then you had this peculiar thing, which was very good. When the zones, at the end of the war, the zones were decided, like the British zone, the German zone, American zone and the Russian zone and so on. Then you had a liaison group that worked with the Russians. They had a liaison group that worked with us, as was the British commanders. I can't remember, it's called Bricksmiths anyway, to the Soviet forces. It was our liaison group with the Soviet forces, and theirs were called Socksmiths. Well, they were just intelligence gatherers. Ours were excellent. This is an instance. We wanted to discover where the boundaries lay between, say, divisions. They had 22 divisions. Because boundaries are weak links. And so if we knew where the boundaries were between divisions, that constituted a weak link. So we set about trying to find out through various means where one division ended and another began. We used all sorts of things. Now, one of the most valuable sources of information was the tunnel that the Americans dug underneath and tapped into the Soviet communication system. This was in Berlin. And they just extended their tunnel a bit further and put their tape recorders on to, Now the Soviets will tell you, oh no, this has never produced anything. Well, it did. And the thing that it produced, which was valuable, were what we call personalities, like Colonel General somebody or other, or Commander this and Commandant that and so on. And these worked out because then they were using their real names, you see. They weren't hiding. When Socksmiths worked, they all had funny names, and we knew who they were, but they'd all got a pseudonym and so on. But anyway, so with those personalities, you could say, we know that he's commanding that and he's commanding that. Then you had to establish where. So we got our Bricksmiths to go out. They had Jeeps and Land Rovers and things like that, and they were entitled to do this and that and the other under an agreement which had been signed at the end of the war between General Robertson and General Malinin, and this was known as the Robertson-Malinin Agreement, you see. And they were all good Russian speakers, obviously, and they'd quote the Robertson-Malinin Agreement, and they'd go and they'd say, start making a meal in the middle of a town. And the Soviets would come along and say, no, you can't do that. No. They said, yes, under the Robertson-Malinin Agreement, we are entitled to have our lunch at whatever time it is, and so on. You say, no, off to the Kommandantur. And of course, then when they got to the Kommandantur, our chaps would be saying, this is ridiculous, this is scandalous, connect me immediately to the Colonel General, you see. And sometimes the idiots did. And he'd say, yes, the Colonel General something here. Well, of course, they knew straight away what he commanded. And so that was it.